Thank you, Kathy. Joanne and I are both from a school just up the road a ways, UCLA, and I think it's probably worth mentioning why we thought this topic was worth talking about. And part of that, I guess I felt empowered listening to the plenary session this morning, because I actually think that lecture capture technology is sort of driving the curriculum in a way that it wouldn't have gone by itself. And it's not often that you see a technology come along and disrupt positively what's going on in the classroom. I could be wrong. I certainly give some room for that possibility. But I think this is a new set of circumstances, and it's worth our time to pay attention to it. Now, UCLA, like many schools, has been doing lecture capture for a number of years. And during that time, we've surveyed our students rather extensively. We've interviewed a lot of faculty. And in this presentation, we want to summarize some of the data. We're not going to show you all the data. We try to do a survey every quarter, usually 10 to 12 questions. But the questions keep changing, or some of the questions kept changing. So a lot of the data is just garbage anyway. So I want to hit the high points here for you. And if you're in a hurry or you were unsure whether you wanted to come to this session or another session, I can just tell you right now, the short answer to this is it's changed, but probably not as much as you might think. So back in 2007, and I have to say it seems like it was a lot longer ago than that, but it was only in 2007, we surveyed 12 comparison institutions and found that all of them did podcasting and 9 of them did webcasting. Now all of them do webcasting to some extent. The number of classes that are being webcast isn't enormous in terms of the representative percentage of the entire curriculum, but everyone seems quite confident that both the number of lectures and the type of class formats is going to increase. One thing holding many people back, and almost everyone mentions this, is that the expense of webcasting is still a significant obstacle for them. But there are hopeful signs out there, too. And if any of you went to that session this morning on Matterhorn Opencast, I find that to be really promising and one of those areas of development that I think it's all worth our time to pay attention to. As the market grows, there are more and more choices available if you want to go with a vendor. The problem with vendors is the big fish eat the little fish, and they keep getting bigger, and sometimes the little fish are fast enough to swim away and they'll survive. And that's led a lot of people to use homegrown systems and then wait until the appropriate time when there's either a price point or a market model that they like and switch from homegrown to a vendor-provide system. Whatever the price point is, the market is big already. And it's predicted to increase by a factor of 3 or more within the next 5 years. Quite honestly, I think that might be a conservative estimate. On the other hand, if I look at the budget of the state of California, maybe that's an optimistic estimate because things don't look so rosy. One good question is, why do lecture capture and web streaming at all? Well, initially, I think a lot of the efforts were basically experimental. It was, you know, a bunch of tech guys saying, I wonder if we can do this. And, of course, it turned out that they could. The interesting thing is that I don't know of any instance where a campus has done any kind of lecture capture and web streaming and then decided not to continue it. Almost everyone has considered it to be one of those things that once you've done it, there's no turning back and you just keep pressing on forward. some of the arguments that were put out early on were not particularly overwhelming. Some of them were suggesting that lecture capture could be used to accommodate faculty travel schedules, or just simply that the students wanted it, or because they thought it basically gave students material that they could use at their own pace. But the most compelling argument, and the one that I think almost every school has to pay attention to, is because they believed it was going to improve learning. Now, since that time, in the last few years, there have been a number of other arguments put out there, such as creating a buffer in the case of pandemic disasters or reducing overcrowding in lecture halls. And most recently, and I find this to be the kind of revolutionary or developmental sector, is faculty taking parts of their lectures and re-editing or repurposing them into new kinds of materials, sometimes creating standalone modules, sometimes creating quiz tools that exist separate from the lectures themselves. As Mara Hancock put it this morning, it's also that effort to move from lecture 1.0 to maybe lecture 1.5 on your way to a more evolved and interactive type of lecture environment. But I guess the thing that strikes me is that with this potential market growth to over $150 million annually, the evidence for improved learning must be pretty rock solid and really overwhelming. Unfortunately, that's not true. There are huge amounts of information out there on statistical matters like the number of downloads, student viewing time, student satisfaction, all that. But there's very little information about how students actually use the material and very little evaluation about whether or not it increases learning. Now, to be sure, there are some studies out there, and people can often find one or two that support their positions. But many of these studies have limiting factors, whether or not it's sample size or the kind of materials that were being taught, external variables that may not have much to do with the lecture delivery itself. So I think this is an area that's still wide open for exploration. Initially, faculty were not convinced, or I should say most faculty were not convinced, that webcasting was a good direction to go. Now that more of them have experience, it's won over most of the doubters. Sometimes campuses had to develop workarounds in order to make these concerns go away. But the primary concern that students would stop coming to class has proven to be both true and to be overstated. And I'll tell you more about that later. So first, let me just provide a little snapshot of what our experience is to date. This is first number is really a lie. We don't really know how many podcasts there are per quarter at UCLA. All of our 200 classrooms are podcast capable, and since faculty can do it on their own without our help, this is just our best estimate. The number of webcasts was initially fairly small, but this has now grown to what is our current capacity level. We have a peculiar way of assigning, well, I think most campuses have peculiar ways of assigning classes to rooms. You know, you'd think it'd be based on class size, but it's often on who is the most senior faculty and the least willing to walk the farthest from their office or some other algorithm that doesn't necessarily make sense. But because of this, we can't always do the same number of webcasts per quarter. So this is sort of the range of our maximum. Right now, we have had that kind of, I don't know if it's a good or bad experience, of having to turn away anywhere from 15 to 20% of the faculty who want to do lecture capture. We can't accommodate them with our current system and our current classroom space, so we're trying to resolve this demand model. I'd also like to insert a note of caution for any of you who are thinking about expanding beyond a pilot program. Once faculty use lecture capture, they very quickly take on the attitude that it's an entitlement and that they need to have it every time they teach. And for some faculty, I'm very sympathetic to that point of view because they may have actually modified their class materials or their presentations to account for lecture capture, and when they don't get it, they're unhappy. And we all know that unhappy faculty is an ugly situation. So if you're going to go into one of these programs, make it clear in advance that you can't guarantee the availability of the service for everyone every time unless you have a much better budget than we happen to have. And finally, a note about the response rates. While they were okay in the beginning, and unfortunately in the beginning we were asking, you know, kind of logistical questions, you know, how did you access it? How was the picture? How was the sound? You know, kind of boring routine stuff. continued surveying has had its own drawbacks. I call it survey fatigue. Our undergraduates are asked about everything all the time, you know, how'd you like the food, is the grass too short, et cetera, et cetera. And they get tired of responding. So if they've taken a class that's been webcast before, they're likely to ignore our pleas to participate in the survey. And in some of these classes, the response rate has dipped as low as 11%. So we have to figure out a better incentive to get them to participate if we want to have any faith in the data whatsoever. These are the basic characteristics of our webcast format. We call it Bruincast. Our mascot is the Bruin Bear, and everything's Bruin something on our campus, so why not Bruincast? And we've tried to have reasonably high production values. I know you may have heard people say that quality doesn't matter, and that's probably based on the fact that students will sit and they will watch anything as long as there's an image on the screen, no matter how bad that quality is. But it seems to me that if you're trying to increase student learning, why not do the best job that you can? My argument is that if you've got a traveler dying of thirst out in the desert, they'll probably drink muddy water. But that doesn't mean that they like muddy water, and it doesn't mean that muddy water is good for them. Why not provide clean water? So I think good production values are like clean water, and we ought to do the best job that we can. Two of the most unusual variables that we found when looking at other campuses were when the materials were posted, how quickly they got posted after the lecture itself, and how long they remained available. In one pre-med life science course that we offer, students felt that a delay of more than 2 hours was simply unacceptable, that other students were getting a competitive advantage, and, you know, we had to respond more quickly than that. Even the more patient students, though, have been known, particularly if we have an equipment malfunction or a network malfunction, they'll start raining in emails saying, is it up yet? Is it up yet? Is it up yet? And, of course, we can say, sorry, we didn't guarantee that all these lectures would be online. At UCLA, the lecture materials, once they're up, once they're posted, stay up for the remainder of the quarter. And in our survey of other institutions, we found a number of different practices, some of them limiting the time period or some of them waiting a while before they posted them. In my experience, there's no argument to taking them down after a week or two. Some people claim that that encourages student procrastination. I don't think there's a lot of evidence for that, or at least I don't know of any student who's ever done that twice. They learn quickly that procrastination is death, and I don't think that's true of their behavior. And it really crimps the ability to use the materials in a way that induces the most amount of learning. One other note I should make is that 90% of our faculty keep their lectures behind a password, and they only make those lectures available to students who are enrolled in the course currently. Now, when we've asked faculty about that, most of them claim that they're worried about controlling the content of their lectures. And that may be true. It seems a little strange to me that so many of our faculty are writing introductory textbooks, but apparently that's how they feel about it, and we're not about to argue. When we began our pilot project, we thought there were some particular target groups who would probably use materials more than others. Our first assumption was about students for whom English is a second language, and that proved to be completely unfounded. There was no difference in that population from our regular English-speaking students. In the second case, we found that there was a very small association in viewing satisfaction with courses that have high numbers of new vocabulary words. But this was often confounded by other factors, again, pre-med students and their very competitive personality. So I wouldn't want to extend that argument very far. And finally, when we looked at STEM classes, you're familiar with STEM, science, technology, engineering, math, okay, STEM classes, we thought that that would be a more popular area, and it turned out that was not the case. Again, STEM students and humanities and social sciences, I all look at it the same way. So essentially, none of our original assumptions proved to be correct, and that's just the way it is sometimes. What we might have done, instead of looking at the student populations, was look at the faculty populations. And here, this is just data from this last year. But here we start to see a much greater interest in the use of webcasts by STEM faculty. And I apologize for the chart. I don't know what I was thinking, but just, you know, you can ignore most of it. But this, these bottom two lines here are probably, you know, the significant numbers here. There's almost 3.5 times more STEM classes that seek the webcast option as the non-STEM. A small amount of this can be attributed to the fact that STEM classes do rely more on large lectures for introductory materials, but it doesn't account for all of the difference. And the remainder of that difference, I think, is faculty satisfaction with the experience. Students have modified their behavior when lecture capture is available, and the faculty like the way that students have responded to it. We did interviews with lots of faculty. Actually, Joanne did the interviews, and I merely looked at the results. But the favorable comments from faculty were very strong in terms of the class preparation for by the students. They felt that it had totally changed the atmosphere of their office hours. Students came in with particular questions. They had they could quote the exact sentence that an instructor had made in class and say, "Now, what did you really mean by that?" Another frequent comment was faculty who appreciated the ability to respond to students who enroll late. I mean, we're on a quarter system, which I realize isn't very popular, but we only have 10 weeks, and students can enroll in a class as late as the second week. And nothing drives the faculty crazier than somebody coming in and saying, "Did you say anything important in the first 2 weeks?" You know, it's like, yes, go look at the lectures, and you can catch yourself up. Don't count on me. A growing use of pre-recorded lectures is trying to assign previous year's lectures as preparation for a lecture that's coming up. That may not sound very clear, but it's in a sense creating sort of an anticipation amongst the students as for what they're going to see later on. Sometimes faculty are taking these materials and they're editing them into prep work. They're creating reference files, help files, et cetera, and they provide that either in advance of the lecture or as an addition to the course offerings overall. To return to the original major concern of the faculty attendance, we found that indeed some students were less likely to attend class, especially if that class was a non-interactive lecture. Sometimes I think we need to emphasize to faculty that if you don't give students a reason not to miss class, they don't mind missing the class. The bigger surprise here, however, was the number of students who said it increased the likelihood of attending class. This was 6% when we first posed this question back in 2005 and 7. I find this to be sort of a healthy sign, and when we look at the data later on, we find that that number increased even more. Now, one of our own hypotheses was that if we split this between STEM students and non-STEM students, who do you think is more likely to miss class willingly? STEM? Non-STEM? Yeah. Well, we were wrong again. As it turns out, more non-STEM students are comfortable. Oops, did I miss a slide? I got a bad slide. Okay, my apologies. Bad slide. This first column are the STEM students. These are the non-STEM students. And as it turns out, the STEM students are more likely to miss class. That's certainly not what we expected. Another difference as we look at the data later on shows that a larger or a lower percentage of the students say that their attendance wasn't affected at all by having webcast lectures available. Now, we don't know what their attendance was to begin with, so I wouldn't make too many assumptions, but when we look at end of the quarter, in-class evaluations, et cetera, about 86% of the enrolled students are present in class. And we decided to check that actually by just going in and doing random headcounts, not for all of them, obviously, and that number seemed to hold reasonably true. There are classes, however, especially 8 a.m. classes, especially 8 a.m. narrative lectures with no interaction that drone on and on, where you might find as much as 50% absenteeism, and that turned out to be true whether there was webcasts available or not. The students provided us with a lot of information about both the positive and negative changes in their attendance. I think the thing that came through loud and clear was that they absolutely value the opportunity for flexibility in their time obligations. As more of our students have heavier work and family expectations made upon them than in previous generations, they find that flexibility is really key for their ability to keep up with the work. So in this case, I'd say we couldn't say that webcasts necessarily were helping them to learn more, but it was giving them a better opportunity to learn despite the other challenges in their life. Although this slide differentiates STEM from non-STEM classes, the viewing behaviors are pretty similar, and they vary more based on which courses were being offered in a particular quarter than in any essential difference in the two categories. Once we got past the introductory stage here, viewing increased, and I think you can see that it tends to increase overall through time. Students are looking more often at the webcasts, but they're looking more at segments rather than watching the whole lecture. And likewise, there seem to be fewer of the obsessive compulsive students who are sitting down and watching a lecture, you know, 7, 8, 9 times, and God help them. I don't know how they find the time for that in the first place, but more simply did not prove to be better, and most of that behavior has stopped. Now, clearly, student familiarity with webcast lectures has minimized the difference in their preferences of live lecture, which is the purple here, versus the webcast, which is in red. I would also argue that this is probably one of the major reasons for better production values. The better the quality of the materials that are webcast, the more students perceive it as being comparable to a live lecture. And as you move away from just recording the lecture itself, but start to look at rich media, which annotates either lecture notes or other presentations by the faculty, the tendency is to even prefer the webcast more so than the live lecture. Here at the beginning, I think this huge difference was because we were probably not very good ourselves in recording and playing things back at the beginning. Now, over time, we see the differences are greatly reduced. This is also true when we look at STEM versus non-STEM students. This is a chart of the preferences of non-STEM, and I didn't show STEM because it looks almost exactly the same. Webcast acceptance is slowly but steadily increasing. So for this question in our survey, I should have said, do you think it positively affected your learning in the class? And 95% of the students think it was helpful, whether they're STEM or non-STEM. I have to offer a caveat here, and it's a huge one, and I think we need to keep it in mind all the time, that students tend to define learning as how well they do on the next test. It doesn't have anything to do with incorporating complex ideas into a new schema or a new worldview or having long-term retention of information. It's simply, did I do better on the test or not? They know that it does help them do better on the test. I don't think we can make the jump and say that it absolutely shows an increase in learning. Certainly an increase in satisfaction, but learning is a longer stretch. However, we do know that there are factors that improve learning. And this is far from being an exhaustive list, but this is a list of issues that can easily be addressed with lecture capture. And I think the last one, spacing out the study sessions, is probably the most critical one in terms of helping them remember material. Half of the students said that having webcasts made no difference in their study behavior. I think the danger in reading the results to this question is the assumption that they had any decent study habits in the first place or were even conscious of useful behaviors in studying. But the most important response here, again, is that 10% who said that they were more likely to space out their studying through the course of the lecture. So that repetition over time ended up helping them retain information. Now, this is some data from a faculty member in our psychology department, Robert Bjork, who's a cognitive psychologist and very interested in how students approach their work. And he started asking students in his introductory class how they organize their study plans. And probably no surprise, they do whatever is due the soonest. Okay, that's what they decide to focus on. Now, we might like to think that we ourselves in our work behaviors come up with a priority list and we attend the highest priorities. But the truth is, as I look at my own calendar, I tend to do whatever is due soonest. And students are that way, but perhaps even more so. So although I think students are very willing to work hard and study hard, they may need advice on how to study effectively. And they certainly need advice on how to use webcasts in their study plan. This seems like a very useful step for faculty to offer or for TAs to offer if you should be so lucky as to still have TAs. But I think students need guidance rather than just sitting and watching webcasts. One question we wondered about is, when do students look at webcast lectures? And the short answer is they look at them all the time. There was no period of the day that somebody wasn't looking at something. Now, this may be a slightly biased chart. This is the, 24 hours starting at midnight here with number one. We do have some faculty who don't put their lectures behind a password, so they are basically drawing an international audience. And it's probably worth remembering that when it's 3 a.m. in L.A., it's only 8 p.m. in Tokyo, and the lights are still on all over China, and there's probably a fair number of viewers who are looking at it from that location. What we can see, though, is that the students are more selective in their viewing behavior in the afternoon and early evening hours. This suggests that they are looking through the material for a particular question, a particular review item, rather than sitting and watching the whole thing played through in a linear fashion. One of the biggest changes over time has been what I call the evening out of viewing based on the days of the week. When we first looked at it, viewership was way up on Sunday, way down on Friday, and the rest were pretty much even. Friday has kind of regained its importance, and it's only slightly down from the other days. We do know that most of the viewers look at lectures within 48 hours after they've been posted. The ones who are looking at them two or three times are indeed spacing them out over the quarter. So they are finding it useful to have those materials available later on in the course. So going back to that earlier slide that showed students are highly convinced that webcasts contribute to their learning, is there any chance that it's true? So we did a couple of experiments. And when I'm almost nervous to use the word experiment because our institutional review board doesn't like to think of us as experimenting on our students as we're teaching them. So let's just say we had a happy opportunity where an instructor was teaching two sections of an introductory psych course in the same quarter, in the same room, on the same days, and the only difference was one was at 11 a.m. and one was at 2 p.m., and one of them we could webcast and one of them we couldn't, and so we just sort of took that data and began to compare. The results were that even though attendance went down about 15% with webcasting, the student performance on their final exam, and it was a multiple-choice final exam, was slightly better. In fact, it was statistically significant. Now, I won't say it was a huge improvement, but it was enough that it was noticeable. There are other issues that may have confounded this result. Even the instructor said, you know, maybe I just got better through practice and that the second offering of the course was smoother because I had already had a chance to run through it in the morning. But even so, I think there's some suggestion here that lecture capture may have slightly helped those students. In a second experiment or a second example, we had a problem with a chemistry course that students needed in order to move on to the next sequence. And I can only say that I think this, if you don't have this experience already of students not being able to access the courses they need, you probably will in the future. It's sometimes tough to offer the full slate of courses that we need in the curriculum. So we compensated for this by deliberately over-enrolling the class. They had both a lecture and a discussion section. All the discussion sections were live, but about a third of the class promised to not attend the live lecture. Now, we didn't check up on them or throw them out of the door, you know, if they tried to come to the live lecture, but they self-reported that they indeed did not come to class. The performance on the final exam showed no difference whatsoever. The other result was that students who had the online experience expressed more satisfaction with the course, and they were more willing to consider trying another course in the future. So while we can't definitively say that webcasting increased student learning, we can certainly say that we have confidence here that it did them no harm. So let me just sum it up. Students certainly can improve their study behaviors through the use of webcasting, but it helps if they're given direction, even modest direction, on how best to take advantage of the webcasts. Faculty can begin to use pre-recorded lectures to develop new teaching materials and even begin to frame the delivery of a completely online course as a result. Students, once they are used to using a webcast course, are more open to doing it again. As webcasts become more commonplace over time, they collectively have learned how to use the materials more intelligently, more sparingly, and to their better advantage. Faculty, in turn, appreciate the student response, the better preparation, the more pointed questions that they get, whether it's in office hours or via classroom bulletin board. And finally, we can still say that webcasts do no harm. Now, for any of you who are interested, I think there's a great deal of opportunity in looking at student study behavior with webcast materials. I mean, certainly we do know that whole procrastination issue. We had a fair number of students who thought they could take a 10-week course, you know, on the very last day before the final exam. Let's just sit and have a watching marathon, and I'll learn all the material. Not so, and students were very quick to tell each other, don't ever try that. This is a big mistake. And word of mouth among students has helped a lot in terms of getting information out there. But we don't know very much at all about student feedback in this kind of a class format. We don't know much about instructor-student feedback. We don't know much about student-student feedback. And likewise, we don't know very much about collective student study behavior. We do have evidence in other courses that collective studying certainly improves student performance. is sitting watching a webcast lecture likely to diminish that, or do they use it as a supplementary kind of activity? We simply don't know. And if anyone is interested in further exploring these topics, we'd be happy to help share what information we have and get the results of your data as well. So that's the quick part. If you have questions, I will offer Joanne to answer them, or I will do my best to answer them for you. Questions? Yes.
Are you assuming an instructor is pedagogy
here? I'm sorry?
Are you assuming an instructor is pedagogy?
An instructorless pedagogy? You mean of the lectures that we've recorded?
Yeah.
For the most part, that is exactly what it is, yes. Primarily, we have limited ourselves to larger lecture halls that have, say, a capacity of 120 seats or more, and that's pretty much the model that we follow. There isn't a lot of interaction in most of these classes. Yeah, I think that's an excellent point. And certainly instructors who are hired exclusively on teaching contracts who don't have research obligations are very concerned about what happens to the lecture after it's captured. Who owns it? Who can see it? Who has control over it? There are some places where lecturers are unionized, and they have already urged that there be an adoption of, say, a practice that no one can show a pre-recorded lecture unless the original person who delivered it is present in the classroom at the time. I mean, there's all kinds of variations on that, but it's a very good question. I have often, well, we've experimented, as many people have, with blended instruction, and we've certainly seen that the need to be better organized for a pre-recorded lecture often means that you can take a one-hour class and reduce it by 10, 15 minutes or so. And to go even a step further, students are sometimes willing to, you know, play it at 1.5 times normal speed. So suddenly your lecture has become just a fragment of what it was originally offered. And it's a very good question of what is it we think we're doing in the classroom under those circumstances? And can't we, as you suggest, offer more important interactive experiences? I know a lot of people think the clickers will be the answer to that. And probably an equally large group have tried it and abandoned it because it turns out to be harder than it looks. Yeah?
Did you control for student rank? In other words, would you, I saw intro to psych up there, a survey level course for underclassmen.
Mm-hmm.
Did you control and examine student behavior patterns for, say, seniors or capstone courses?
No, and that's something that we would like to do, and the reason that we haven't done it is that, number one, we don't have any way of identifying what year the student is. I suppose we could ask them, but we hadn't thought of that up till now. And likewise, most of the upper division curriculum doesn't really follow the lecture format. There are some exceptions to that, but there hasn't been as much for us to look at. But those are good ideas, and I think we will probably move to more intermediate-sized courses in the future. Yes? I think the suggestion is that we could perhaps try and reduce labor costs by focusing on the screen. Is that correct? It's a good idea. It turns out that there are, in our case, we decided not to do that because sometimes you ended up with the camera being pointed at the wall instead of at the screen. Who knows why? Having a live person operating the camera, and we actually can monitor it remotely, we can pretty much assure ourselves that the person's being recorded appropriately. We had a very uncomfortable situation where one student operator used it as a chance to, how should I put it, scope out the class and see who is most attractive. Yeah, those things we've had to, you know, come down very hard on and say, no, we need to focus on the instructor. We also have problems with the instructors who like to pace. And they both pace in front of the screen or around the class, and it's hard to follow them. So a fixed camera hasn't been a good solution, but we've actually thought about using security cameras that are used to switching based on motion, and using that, you know, presetting them in different segments of the classroom. that hasn't worked as well as we hoped. And to be honest with you, we're probably likely to switch to a more vendor-supported system in the future rather than relying on some of our own homegrown stuff, with most likely a remote control of the camera itself. That's an excellent point, and I think we'll probably pursue what you just suggested, seeing if there are indeed students who prefer the opportunity to relax a little more in class, if you will, and not focus on note-taking, but instead focus on the flow of information or the ideas being expressed in the class. It's an excellent point.
If I may add, when we tried to do student – can you hear me? I'm sorry. We attempted to do student focus groups at one point regarding BruinCast, and the numbers of participants were so low that a lot of the data ended up being anecdotal. But there were more than a few students who made the comment that this allowed them to pay attention in the lecture, and then go back and review it. But then they said that at first they paid attention without taking notes. And then they went back and viewed it, and they realized that part of absorbing it was taking notes. So we have one faculty member in particular who now instructs his students, take notes, because you learn as you take notes, but be a little bit more relaxed. You don't have to get every single word, because then you can go back. But that's a very good point to follow.
Actually, you remind me that one of our most successful experiments with blended instruction was where the instructor pre-recorded every other lecture. And unfortunately, it was a political science class, and the lectures couldn't be used over again because the world moved on from one quarter to the next. But nonetheless, in that experiment, they did exactly what you're suggesting. They focused on issues that came out of the students' either ability or inability to absorb information and made that the second part of the course in that given week. I might also add that one of the most common statements we get from faculty, from the male faculty at least, when they do lecture captures, like, wow, I didn't know I had a bald spot. And they become a little concerned on how they appear. And one of the changes that we're making as a result is to actually light our classrooms better so that there is, you know, not these shadows abruptly coming down from their face, but you can really see their faces. And it makes everyone look better. Yes. Well, it's a good question. Some of it has to do with body posture and language. Some of it has to do with other materials that are being presented in the course. We've certainly learned that some faculty will put up, particularly in chemistry, a series of equations on the board and then start to refer to them. So without the video, you don't know which equation is being in fact, you don't even know what the equation is necessarily, unless it's been provided separately. But even then, you can't tell which one the instructor is pointing to. Which, by the way, it was another problem when we had, say, a history student recording a chemistry class, and you know, the instructor would say, "Well, you know, look at what happens to the ferrous materials," and the kid doesn't know where to put that camera view. So that has been a problem as well. I think that sounds great. I mean, one of my responses to the statement about, you know, will we ever be at the point where the 10 best instructors in the world will deliver all the instruction? Well, if that's the case, who gives the degree? You know, I mean, there has to be some accountability in another arena for that. Okay, I'm being waved at, so one last question, and we'll...
No, I was going to say that...
Good point. All right. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate your time and attention.